Hello, everybody. This is Maddie Marr. This is a podcast. Rick Grant Coons, you're in my apartment, in my new chair. Everybody, this is Matt Marr, and I'm with a real clinical psychologist, or Dr. Rick Grant Coons. Is it clinic? You're a psychologist?
What yes.
is your... Okay.
Yes. Got my PsyD and then became licensed as a clinical psychologist.
Now, what is for people like... what is? I know what PsyD is, but some people don't know what that is, so...
So, a PsyD is a more clinical version of the PhD. So, it's less research-focused, mm-hmm. and it's much more... there's much more emphasis on the clinical work.
So, you... which means you saw a lot of fucking clients.
Saw a lot of clients.
Yeah.
Yeah, for 10 years.
Can you tell us about them right now? Tell us, who's your favorite one?
Yes, let me break all the confidentiality and tell you all about it.
Now, you tell me again, do you need to stretch your feet? Dr. Rick Grant Coons is doing this, y'all, with a pinched nerve. This is in his back. This is Dear Maddie Live.
Yes.
So I appreciate it. But let me know if you need to stop or put your feet out. So tell everybody, this again, I always ask, tell everybody how we met, how we know one another.
I think we first met during our practicum it was my practicum and traineeship at the LA Gay and Lesbian Center.
Yep.
And which is basically our first time with clients.
Yes.
It was that year. And I just remember us, we had that one hall or whatever that room was that had like four or five computers.
It was like a hallway.
It was basically
just like they threw this in a hallway.
Yes. And we all had to use those computers to do notes and stuff. So it was a very busy space. But it was also where we got to hang out and talk, you know, because otherwise we were off in little rooms
seeing people,
with our clients. Yeah.
That's where I met. I knew that I liked you because you would make inappropriate jokes like I would.
Yes, yeah. I think it's necessary.
I think it is. And then I found out you're Southern. So you're really Southern. I'm white trash. I'm Oklahoma. But you're from Kentucky?
Tennessee.
Oh, Tennessee.
Yeah, mostly. Yeah.
What parts of Tennessee?
I was born in Clarksville, so that's the western end of the state. And then I went to high school in the eastern part of the state in Johnson City.
So... how'd you lose your accent?
Well, in between Clarksville and Johnson City, I moved up to Massachusetts with my father's side, and was half childhood up there.
So Yankees,
So I've Southern and Yankee in me pretty equally.
So and then how did you move out to California? How did that? Weren't you an actor? But you were an actor.
Yeah, I was in
musical theater queen.
That little
was me.
Bit.
That
little
was
bit.
Me.
But I did. I studied dramatic performance.
Okay. You did fucking Shakespeare. All right. I sang Sondheim. Whatever. You did Shakespeare. You win.
Yeah. At the University of Cincinnati. And
I forgot you went. That's a really good school.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Really great 4 years. And that's where. And I wasn't in the musical theater program there, but the musical theater program there is
it's like
out of this world.
It is out of this world.
And I see now, like, you know, almost 20 years later, and I'm looking at shows or seeing who's in the new Broadway show, and there's always someone I recognize.
Someone from CCM.
From that school.
That's how I feel about, because I started my master's in performance at OCU.
Uh-huh.
Oklahoma. I don't know why, like, the best musical theater schools are in Cincinnati and Oklahoma fucking City.
Yeah.
But they are.
Yeah.
They are. It's very random.
Yeah, like Carnegie Mellon, that's like in North Carolina.
Yeah, that's in North Carolina. Yeah.
Yeah, they got these amazing programs. And
so were you bit by the bug at a young age, or are there videos and pictures of you acting the fool?
Yes. I think I was 12. Well, when I did like my first musical, like real show. And that's when I knew I was going to pursue it. And
what musical was it?
Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Oh, my God. Were you Joseph?
No, I was one of the brothers.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's when it bit me, and did as much as I could in high school and any community theater, any college show that I could do, and then went to UC, which was the highlight. That was the peak of all the shows that we got to do, and the caliber, the level of talent and skill. and then moved to New York, and I had a different idea of what a career in acting was going to look like. I thought, you know, I'll spend a couple of years being the struggling actor, and then I'll
big.
Exactly.
That's the way it worked. It only takes 2 years.
Yeah, just a couple years.
Yeah.
It was going to work out. And after 2 years, it was not working out like
and it's
that.
So, but it's so cheap, though, to live in New York at least. At least
I know, so easy. I worked a part-time job.
Yeah,
that was it.
Yeah, you just whenever you wanted to.
Whenever I wanted, it was no big deal. No, it was from. Well, it was such an interesting time because I was there from '99 to 2002.
Okay.
And the city was when I like first got there. I had $500 in my pocket, and I found a rent a room by the week in Hell's Kitchen.
Oh my goodness! And that's when Hell's Kitchen was not pretty.
Yeah, it was a little scary. There, right across my window was a church with a cross, and it said, "Sin will find you out."
Oh my! Wow.
That was my like welcome to New York. Wow. Here I'm living, and the room was 9 by 11. That was
really
spacious.
Well, I was interested in that too. That's something you brought up about sin. Like, what was it like moving from, as a gay man, moving from like Tennessee, going to New York, where there's just dicks hitting you in the face, though, pretty much.
Right. Well, Cincinnati was my buffer, like my in between.
Oh, that's true.
Because that was my first big city in my mind. Cincinnati was a huge city. And that they had, but although going back to Johnson City, they had a gay bar. So when I was in high school, that was my very first gay bar. It was called New Beginnings.
Oh. I love that.
Oh, yeah. It was the only, and still there, and hasn't changed much, but it's like.
Do you walk in when you go back home and say hi?
Yeah. Every time I go home, I at least go for one night to check it out. Same bartenders, new faces, but pretty much the same layout.
That's very like that documentary, Small Town Gay Bar.
Yeah, yeah, very much so, very much so. And it was where I just really came out was in Tennessee. And
in high school?
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I came out at 16, sophomore year.
Good for you. Wish I could have done that.
Yeah.
To everybody, to your parents and everything?
Parents came later, probably around 17. But because of my experience in Massachusetts coming to Tennessee, I was not bound by the same restrictions of coming out. Mm-hmm. It wasn't such like, oh, if I come out, I lose all my friends that I've known all my life. It was, I'd only been there about a year or two.
Okay.
And it was, I just couldn't fight it anymore. It was just, I can't.
The glitter is coming out.
I couldn't hold it back. It was just too, I was like, come on.
Were you raised religious or anything like that?
Not really. Which
helpful.
Yeah, it was very helpful.
If there's anything wrong with the religion, people, but in the South, let's just talk about it. It's rough for us sometimes.
It was tough. And I still had my battles there actually before I came out, I had a lot more pushback than when I came out. It was kind of interesting. When I came out, everyone was like, great, and wanted to be a friend. And it was kind of like I took the ammo away from the shame that I was experiencing. Mm-hmm. Because before I came out, that's when the bullying happened. That's when the name calling happened. But once I came out, it was like, well, you can call me those things anymore, but I kind of know already. Yeah. So does everyone else.
I am a butt pirate. Thank you. Yeah. Aye. Give me your booty.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So that was a really empowering experience. And I just had my 20th high school reunion just last summer.
Oh, wow. So you're 38, 37?
38. Yeah. 38. And
was it like being the prettiest? Because I bet they were fat in the South, and you still are like a Greek Adonis over here.
It was kind of interesting coming back. One person just said, just looked at me. I hadn't seen her in 20 years, and she was like, just shut up. Just shut up. Why don't you age, please?
If I looked like you, I'd wear something so form-fitting. That'd be in a fucking girdle.
Yeah, they were asking about, the guys would stand around and like, why do you work out all the time? I'm just like, it's L.A.
You have to have
a gym membership or you're booted.
It's true. I'm signing up for one this week, actually. It's a different
mindset. I don't even think they have any chain gyms in Johnson City. There's gyms, but like there's no like Bally's or I don't even think there's any Bally's anymore anyway.
But like in LA Fitness or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's none of those.
Did but what was that like going to the reunion? But was everybody I feel like people don't give a fuck anymore about that kind of stuff, or did they?
No, I mean, because I was out in high school, coming back, I was pretty much, you know, still who I was then, at least, you know, mm-hmm. you know. I had, you know, I was out. They knew about my sexuality. Facebook. I mean, there was really.
Facebook has really helped. Exactly. It's annoying in a lot of ways, but man, it's made things a lot easier.
Yeah. Everyone was caught up. There was no like,
they knew you
like,
were married. Exactly. Did your husband go with you as well?
Actually, he couldn't. I was going to, right afterwards, I was going on a business trip for D.D. Hirsch, where I work now, to a conference in Montreal. So I went right to Tennessee, to Montreal.
Oh, okay.
And Stu couldn't take time off because he works at UCLA Medical Center. So,
did you have that like good? I remember my high school year, just my 10-year one. 20s coming up in 2 years. Mm-hmm. But did you just like? I feel like it was. Honestly, it felt like time had not moved, mm-hmm. and I just got drunk with people in high school again. Like the same thing that happened before. Did you have that type of experience?
The neatest part of the whole trip was when we went back to the school and we're walking around the old classrooms, and
oh wow,
just gave me the new perspective of coming back and seeing the same building, the same rooms I'd seen 20 years ago, but now. You know, all that time has passed.
Yeah.
And now I walk back. And one of the coolest things was on the guidance counselor's office. And I don't mm-hmm. know, all the faculty's different. I don't know who any of these people are, but she had a safe space rainbow sticker
on her
door. And it just, I just stood there in awe.
That would have made me teary.
Yeah. Yeah. Just that 20 years ago, I was the only person that had ever come out at that school ever. Mm-hmm. And now they have rainbow stickers on the door 20 years later. So I thought that was really impressive.
Well, you're not a quiet person. You seem to always even remember if there was like an inequality or something going on at our training. You were always one to speak up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I actually didn't even think about that until right now. Has that always been something that like... I mean, you're very much an activist, mm-hmm. I would say. Mm-hmm. Do you identify with that?
I do, and I would say that it's a part of my work in general mm-hmm. as an activism quality. Mm-hmm. You know, when it comes to, we were there at Prop 8, and mm-hmm. and that was probably my only real march per se mm-hmm. of going down the street and feeling like a true activist. Mm-hmm. But I would say like in my work, in all the classes I was in any of the presentations or the trainings that I do, mm-hmm. There's always a energy that I have about what I'm saying or what I believe in mm-hmm. that I feel has an activism tone to it.
I think so too. Mm-hmm. Very much so. So you moved to, you were in Cincinnati and then you moved from Cincinnati to California. Mm-hmm. No, Cincinnati, New York.
Yeah.
Then you did New York for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then you were like, peace out. Fuck this shit. I want warm weather. Or what happened? What happened?
Well, I actually had a couple of,
Sophie, get away, Sophie.
A
Sorry,
few friends of mine, or actually just three friends of mine, who had been living in New York nearby, and then they had come out to California, and about a year they were here, and, mm-hmm. and I was still in New York, and they had written stuff and produced it, and were doing pretty well, and I thought, they were my closest friends, and mm-hmm. I thought, oh, let me go to where my support is, my closest friendships are, mm-hmm. and around the people that are actually having some beginning success mm-hmm. in the entertainment business. I want to surround myself with mm-hmm. that. So I decided to come out here so I could be closer to them, do more writing, mm-hmm. kind of like do my own thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. But by the time I got out here, the differences in working here versus New York, were noticeable, and I got to a point where I was too tired to learn a new way mm-hmm. of trying to make it in the entertainment mm-hmm. business. The hustle that I needed to have, that I did mm-hmm. have for many years and in New York, I was really straining to have that anymore. So that's mm-hmm. when I started looking at, I'd been here I got here in 2003 and then went back to school in 2005. So in about 2 years, less than 2 years, I'd gotten to a point where I was like, I can't follow this path anymore in entertainment. It's not making me happy. It's not working. And then that's when I shifted gears and went back to school for psychology.
No, Look at you. Mm-hmm. You never. Hey, maybe you never know. You'll come back. I did it and then came back to acting. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that was going to happen.
Yeah.
So who knew?
Maybe. I mean, it's been over 10 years since I've been on stage, but you know, my
Sacramento has a music circus up there.
Yeah, yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful program.
Yeah. So when my husband and I move up there in January, one of my ideas is that because it's not Los Angeles where mm-hmm. every actor here is trying to make it and, mm-hmm. and work and be a professional. I'm wanting to go back to the days where we could just go back and do the community theater shows for fun.
Oh yeah.
You know, just whatever shows and. I want to find that niche again.
Oh, I'm sure you will. And you mm-hmm. never know, too. Like, you know, now I teach classes. The classes I teach are for actors about getting them re-inspired. And it's mm-hmm. It's not therapy because I don't want to deal with that insurance or anything like that. But it is. I use a lot of narrative therapy mm-hmm. techniques. And so, I mean, mm-hmm. that's what I'm learning. I'm finding is having people reconnect with that. Whether it gets them a job or not. I think people take it because they think, oh, I want to book more, so I'm going to take Matt's class. But some of them afterwards have said, oh, actually, I realize I need to work on my marriage right now. And I'm like, wow. That's great. Because we go, I think it's just looking, you know, I think that's what art does mm-hmm. is when art's being used in a true sense of the word is that art just helps you figure out, contemplate, mm-hmm. rediscover, whatever words you want to use for that, mm-hmm. Yourself.
Yeah.
And you know yourself more. And I think that when you were talking about the hustle, for me, that is a lot of that what happens in that hustle is that you keep separating yourself more and more from who you are mm-hmm. and who the artist is. Mm-hmm. And then one day you kind of wake up and you're like, the person that needs to be whatever this is to be an actor mm-hmm. is not anything like I am mm-hmm. at all. At all.
True. Yeah, that really resonates. Because, yeah, it was I was taking it so personally. It became such like, if I don't work, if I don't get a job, you know, my whole sense of self and who I was and my mm-hmm. worth was so tied to that. And I realized how different that was. It was kind of like when I went into psychology and went back to school, I had like a fresh start and mm-hmm. a fresh perspective. Mm-hmm. And going into it, I had that healthier separation between mm-hmm. what I do for work and who I am as a person. Mm-hmm. And it made things so much easier in learning how to become a therapist and mm-hmm. work with clients and, you know, work with all types of people in a way that was always helpful and effective mm-hmm. Because it wasn't tied to my mm-hmm. sense of self or worth. I could really focus on what are the goals here that I want to achieve, not I must get this or I'm a bad person.
Exactly. 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 What, what are you doing now? You mentioned earlier, yeah. Didi, but you've worked Didi Hirsch. I don't remember the names. It seems like I'm always on your email or Facebook channel. I was like, that girl is moving, figuring it out. But because Didi Hirsch, you're working a lot with suicide, but didn't mm-hmm. also you work a lot with, was it sexual or was it addictive or what did you do?
I had a couple postdocs to get those hours to become a therapist. There's a lot of things that you got to do. And before I got the license, there was a lot of internships and mm-hmm. pre-docs and all of that. So which I loved because it gave me such a variety mm-hmm. of different experience with different populations, different types of therapy. Mm-hmm. And then in my postdoc, so after you get your degree, then you still have to get 1,500 more hours before you can get your license. Mm-hmm. But after you have your degree, and I had two sites. Well, actually, no, I had three sites. I was doing the Institute for Sexual Health mm-hmm. And the DBT Recovery Center in mm-hmm. Beverly Hills. And then I had my private practice that mm-hmm. I was being supervised mm-hmm. that I'd been doing even before I got my license. So mm-hmm. I did private practice for a total of 6 years before I wound it down just recently because mm-hmm. my work at Didi Hirsch at the Suicide Prevention Center, there's so much to juggle.
Yeah.
And I only had one day of private practice and just a handful of clients. And it just wasn't really fair to not be able to pay the attention that you need mm-hmm. to, especially when people are, you know, wanting to reschedule and you're like, no, I have one day a week and that's it. And I really couldn't devote the, mm-hmm. the time that I wanted to. So I decided to just really focus on one. But now that that's coming to an end in January, then now my whole focus now is shifting again. And I'm trying to now again define what I do and how I want to do it. And
you're just a phoenix. From the beginning.
Yeah.
Has there been something for you like that is, I don't know, is there anything that you found either in your work at doing DBT or at D.D. Hirsch or with the Sexual Health Center, is that what you said it's called?
Institute of Sexual Health.
Do you feel like there's something that like is some type of is there maybe like with any of those, I don't know, I'm always interested. I think people sometimes are surprised by, oh, I didn't know that that was a problem for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Like I'm forgetting the name, but it just came out. Robin Williams' wife just came out about with that he has another disease. Oh. He had another disease besides Parkinson's that caused him to be paranoid. It's often associated with Parkinson's or dementia or Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. And they said he had Alzheimer's, early stages of Alzheimer's. He also had Parkinson's, but also in that he had this disease that made him paranoid, like things that he was hiding his keys and socks, trying to keep them safe at one point, and actually makes you see things. And they said for a lot of people, it drastically increases their chances of suicide. Mm-hmm. So one of those things where I went, you know, it was a, I didn't even know people were dealing with that. So do you feel like in your work, there's something that you felt like is really prevalent that people don't talk about?
Well, just suicide in general.
We're going to bring it up, everybody.
I had no idea before I went there and really started to learn more about suicide because, you know, in our training as therapists before we're even licensed, we barely get anything on suicide, which is really weird since...
No, it was shocking, actually. I was at Trevor Project. And that I remember in class, I was the expert about suicide. Yeah. And I'm like...
Yeah.
Whoa, I shouldn't, this should be taught more in school.
Yeah, it's
way to go, Antioch.
Schools.
No, it's all schools. At my other traineeships too.
Yeah, all schools. It's just bizarre how the one field that should be the field to go to when it comes to suicide is the same one that kind of pushes it away because of fear, liability, all those other things. Because I always talk about in my trainings that the only education we got on suicide was in law and ethics class. That was it.
Mm-hmm, pretty much.
You know, just how to protect yourself and how to write about it and chart it.
But not any conversation. That's what why Trevor was, God bless Brian Goldman, who trained me, because he really got us used to actually talking to people about suicide and the difference of suicidality versus imminent suicide and crisis and... I'd practiced all that. That's actually what made me. I did that to volunteer to see if I wanted to go to grad school. So, yeah, I think it's I'm so good. So is that what your training focuses a lot on?
So then with D.D. Hirsch Suicide Prevention Center, I have a couple of focuses. One is on the developing support groups for suicide attempt survivors. Because suicide is, you know, has stigma in it. In itself, but attempt survivors have a whole other level of stigma because usually a lot of the programs are dealing with people that have lost people to suicide and it's painful and grief work and all of that. But attempt survivors, these are the people that attempted to kill themselves and they survived. And there are so few services out there in the country for them. So it's working on groups. We have a support group for them called SOSA, Survivors of Suicide Attempts. Then there's also the trainings that we do. So we'll go out to places that, and there are all kinds of places, mental health agencies, schools, whoever, the Gay and Lesbian Center I went back to, and to give them just some basic suicide prevention awareness training.
Look at you going back to where it's started.
Yeah, saw Susan Holt. And
I love Susan.
Oh, yeah.
She was great.
Still, I tell them to this day, it's still one of the most amazing training for therapists
It is, actually. I think I had a rough start in that. I loved my individual trainer, and then she was an older woman. And when I say older, I mean she was, I think, like 88.
Wow.
And then she fell and broke her hip. Oh, and my God. Then I didn't have supervision for a while. So we had to fix that.
Wow.
We had to fix that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it really, a very supportive mm-hmm. environment.
Mm-hmm.
Very supportive.
And very, and the diversity and types of, I mean, I always that had is a full caseload.
Yeah.
I ran several groups while I was there. So I had like a handful of experience. By
yeah.
the time
what
left.
Groups did you run?
I did the a domestic violence group for survivors of domestic violence, mm-hmm. an anger management group, and a sex and intimacy group.
Oh, that's cool.
Those are the three that I did.
Nice. I did the crystal meth group.
Oh, yeah.
Which I knew nothing about.
Mm.
Not, so
that's
it was
a tough one, too.
It was tough, but yeah. Mike Rizzo was a wonderful guy. So mm-hmm. he I think the first day he was like, what? I was like, that was like Mr. like narrative therapy. He was like, what the fuck are you talking about? I made it work, though. I read so much. I was so scared about that.
Yeah.
I think I read like 10 books in a week just to like try to have an idea of what I was going to do. But that honestly, I think even on this show, I talk a lot. I think not only did I learn about just what crystal meth is, which is oddly enough, now I go back home to Oklahoma and it's a huge problem in Oklahoma. And it wasn't when I left 12 years ago. But now too, I didn't know a lot about addiction. I've luckily, I like bit my nails for a long time and stopped that. But like, I mean, pretty much black dick is it. That's pretty much what I love. That's about it. It's a different type of show, Rick.
Yeah.
Different type of show. But that's about it. So, anyway, I learned a lot. Anyway, we could go on and on about that. People are like, I don't live in LA. I don't know what you're talking about. Although, if you do live in LA and you're near the Hollywood area and you want counseling, gay, straight, whatever, please look at the Gay and Lesbian. It's very inexpensive, and I refer people to there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All the time.
Yeah.
All right. We can start to dig in. Because I want to talk about your nuptials.
Uh-huh.
But our first question, actually, is I got this several weeks ago, and I saved it for you. And so we're going to talk about your nuptials now via a question.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the question is, this is from, I guess it's Julio, J-U-L-I-O. Julio. Well, sounds I hope I don't mess up your name. All right. I'm going to say Julio, 35. Dear Maddie, I've been in a relationship for over 10 years now. And now that gay marriage is legal, my boyfriend suddenly wants to get married. The thing is, we have never discussed this before, and I'm just really not into it at all. We don't have kids, so why do we want to be like straight people? At first, I thought he was joking, but it's become an issue. I feel like we already are a cohesive couple, and I don't understand why he needs a piece of paper to legitimize our relationship. What do you think? So I'm not married, so I'm in a new relationship, so no, I have opinions on this too, but what first comes to mind when you hear Julio? And
sure. Well, I think about that everybody's relationship is different, and there's no one way or one right way. So it's not that every couple should be looking at marriage or not. You know, everyone has to define what's going to work for them. And it sounds like he's in a relationship where they have different ideas of where they would like the relationship to go. That's probably at the heart of it that needs to be addressed, is getting on the same page, whatever that may mean.
Yeah, for sure.
And you know, I'm hearing some definitely about resistance about what's the word, to not be like a straight couple
what is the word? Oh, crap.
I know, we should
it's
know this.
Not incriminate. It's like assimilate.
Assimilate. Yeah, yeah.
There we go.
Now for me, I mean, cause I think also we can, what marriage means, like it can mean a institution that has been around and it's been predominantly for heterosexuals, and you know, I don't, you know, want to be like them just because, or it can mean something else. And I know for me, like, I'd always wanted the opportunity to stand in front of the people that I loved most in the world with the relationship that I wanted to spend my life with and commit to, and stand in front and make those statements, you know, and have that acceptance and support from the people that love me most. And also too, I didn't realize, and that was something I've always been aware of. But what was new for me was actually when we signed the paperwork and it did become legal. Mm-hmm. That didn't have a meaning for me until it happened. And just the weight of the, you know, it made a big difference in the idea of being married and this binding legal, you know, societal contract.
That, so it did change your relationship.
Yeah. Well, it changed definitely the meaning of it, the level we had reached.
How long were you together before you got married?
We were, let's see, I think about 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah, before we had the ceremony.
Okay. Well, and I can see that too. You know, with him, I mean, it's a little bit of, I'm shocked, honestly, that they've been together for over 10 years.
Yeah.
So 25 years old. Mm-hmm. Here you are now, 35. And you never, really? You never talked about marriage? Like, even if you wanted to, like...
Right. Right.
Because I don't know if I know I want to have children. Mm-hmm. I actually don't know if I want to get married.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't feel like, for me right now, wherever that I don't need that. But still, mm-hmm. even like with the guy I'm dating now for like 8 months, there's mm-hmm. been this conversation a little bit of, do you want this?
Yeah.
So maybe I'm reading into too much. I'm trying not to be too much of a therapist, but. Come on, we're both here. But I don't know. I think you kind of mentioned earlier. I'm a little bit of me is kind of like, what else are you not talking about in your relationship?
Right, yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just feel like that's something that organically comes up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's major in any relationship. There are major topics that are addressed. Even if it's just like, yeah, do you want to get married? No. Okay. And then you move on.
Watch Netflix.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, you know, Stu and I know that we're not going to have kids. We're asked mm-hmm. that all the time. Are you going to have kids?
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that we've discussed and we just very early on recognized that, neither of us had that as a goal for mm-hmm. our lives. And
wanted to keep your money.
And we wanted to travel.
And, so, yeah. And have fun.
And have nice things.
Yes.
And it's not necessarily a conversation you have once. You know, there's mm-hmm. Things will change, but when that conversation comes up again, it's kind of like another like, so are we still kind of here with no kids?
I think that's super important. I think people, and maybe this happened for you, Julio, that you have a conversation about something and you feel like, okay, that's solidified. Mm-hmm. Well, no, people change.
Mm-hmm.
So, nothing is solid. I think it is a checking in and a rechecking in mm-hmm. and another check in. And you're just checking in. That's to me is continuing. That's the best thing you can. Well, not the best thing, but I mean, well, yeah. Actually, I think that's one of the best things you can do in a relationship is just check in about with each other. I love what you said too because, you know, yeah, Julio. I mean, yes, you might be. If you're getting married is something straight people have done for centuries or whatever, mm-hmm. Thousands of years. But at the same time, like if your marriage is what, and I think you described this much more poetically than I am, but your marriage is your marriage. So mm-hmm. it's not like a straight person's marriage. It's not like another gay person's marriage mm-hmm. or bisexual. I don't know how you identify, Julio, but I just feel like, I don't know. I don't know kind of what that has to do. Does that really have to do with you and your boyfriend's relationship? What if straight people get married or not? To me, mm-hmm. that's just my opinion. I just think you're putting a lot on the cart, sugar. That's all I think. But yeah. Do you enjoy being married?
I do.
Did you wear white?
We had shark skin gray and shark skin black tuxes.
Where'd you get married?
Massachusetts. We went up to my father's side of the family lives, and it was a
where in Massachusetts?
Manchester by the sea.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the Cape Ann area, it was right on the water.
Beautiful
old stone house made in the 1860s, and outside, and you know the water was back and in the background. And then right as the ceremony ended, it started to rain and downpour. So we all went inside to the stone house while it rained and lit fires and danced and ate. And it was fun.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it was
fun. And all your family was there and friends?
All family was there, parents, brothers, grandparents. And his parents came down and brother and sister. And it was nice, about 70, over 70 people.
Oh, that's a good little wedding.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good little wedding. Yeah, don't you have a dog too?
We have two.
Oh, what kind of dogs do you have?
They're both Chihuahua mixes. Buster Brown is a Chihuahua dachshund.
Oh, I know Buster Brown. You Buster Brown.
And then we got Charlie Brown after that.
Oh, my God. That's so fucking cute and gay. Jesus.
I know. I want a third dog, a female dog, just so I can call her Murphy Brown.
Oh, my God.
Then I'll have the trifecta. But our space isn't big enough for three.
Well, so. In Sacramento.
Sacramento.
You'll be able to get a house.
I'll be pushing it. Yeah.
Like I have a friend who is an attorney. And living in like a little apartment in West Hollywood, and then and they bought this beautiful home.
Yeah, yeah,
nothing it's, like crazy,
it's
but
very different.
I like Sacramento.
Yeah,
I don't know how other. I say that like people don't like it. I actually don't know. I have my first roommate in California. Mm-hmm. She lived up there, Lindsay, Dear Maddie, episode one, and I went there once for Thanksgiving, and I loved it. It was kind of like this weather at Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. It wasn't too cold, but you still got a little bit more of the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
They have the Old Town, I think there. I've never been to, but
I'd been there a couple of times before this job opportunity came up, and always had great experiences there. And I've just kind of gotten to a point where I'm ready for a smaller environment. It's 500,000 people, and that sounds great.
Yeah, no.
And I because I've lived in New York and here. For, almost, 15, 16 years.
You have a lot of friends, I'm assuming, in LA, probably.
I do. I have a handful. And, I've over the 13 years of being here, people have come and gone. So
Well, that's true, because when you move out here and you're young, especially you were pretty, but I was too. But, you're in the clubs, all that kind of stuff. So...
Mm-hmm. And that was all my 20s, yeah.
All your 20s, your friends change and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Anyway, yeah. That's how you know my friend Kobe from those days, right?
Yeah,
Kobe. Dear Maddie, episode four, I think. I always say that everybody I know is on my show. I'm running out of people. Julio, best of luck to you on that. So send us the wedding pictures. Yeah. I'm kidding. Do your thing, Julio. All right. This next message, I think this is very, I did not plan all, well, I did plan that first question for you, but I did not plan the rest of these or the second question for you either, but I think it's very appropriate for your move. This says, Dear Maddie, I really admire you for following your dreams and moving to Los Angeles. Well, thank you. Who's this from? Candy. Thank you, Candy. That's my first girlfriend, Candy Duvak, in kindergarten. Look at that. All right. Anyway, I really admire you for moving to Los Angeles. I have an idea to start a bakery in my hometown. I've researched online, I've tested recipes, and I think at this point I'm just scared to do it. How do I make the leap? This is from Candy, age, is that 28?
Okay.
28. Right. Oh, she's young.
Yeah.
And I'm
definitely in a similar situation, having to move to a new city and start my own business, basically.
Yeah,
from scratch with, not knowing anybody there or having any kind of clientele. But what when I had my private practice before here in Los Angeles, I had a lot of time to kind of develop it, and I was under supervision at first. So I started really slow. And some of the lessons I think I learned in that experience that I'm going to apply now is making sure that you have done all the research that you possibly can and have talked to all the people that you possibly can.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. Talk to people.
Because
the shit you read online is just the shit you read online. Yeah. It's helpful. It's not like a conversation.
Right. Like sitting down in front of an accountant and saying, these are my ideas. What do I need to do? Because there were a lot of things that I stumbled upon and learned about because I didn't know I needed them or what I needed. And it's like, oh, I need to pay city taxes. Okay.
Okay.
How do I do that?
Yeah,
so now that I'm aware of those things, I'm going in much more prepared. But a lot of that requires... I just, talked to James Gay. I don't know if you know him. He's a therapist.
The name.
He moved from San Francisco to Los Angeles and really great therapist. And I just got him on the phone and just said, hey, what was your experience like? What should I be doing now to prepare myself for a move to a new city? He had a lot of great input, and it's just really going to people who know, because there's been so many people on this earth. Someone's done it before.
Yes. There's no new ideas.
Exactly. So find out who those people are. Talk to them. Get their insight. And it'll save you a lot of grief if you can do it that way.
Well, you really are a therapist, because that's everything in a nutshell. I would have said, yeah, Candy, I think, you know, and you still might talk to people and still be scared to do it. I think there's nothing, I think at some point, there, and we all have that's just fear. We're talking about fear, mm-hmm. and fear always is going to be there. And the only thing that things can lessen fear, make it less powerful, mm-hmm. but it never really, it never goes away. And really the only reward I think that comes is actually saying, I'm going to do this in spite of the fear, mm-hmm. Candy. So if you're waiting for the fear to go away, or if there's anxiety with starting a business to go away, well, that's sugar. That's not ever going to go away because you care about it. So, but do it instead. But that said, I agree with you in that, I also want to say, I don't know what the size of your town is, but are there other bakers there? Mm-hmm. Like, are you working in a bakery now, or could you intern at a bakery? Like we said earlier, I volunteered for a Trevor Project because I thought if I'm talking to someone with their knife to their wrist and talking them out of suicide, if I can do that, then I can be a therapist. And mm-hmm. that was kind of my thinking, and that paid off. That it sounds maybe weird, but I liked doing that. Mm-hmm. I didn't like that there were suicide, but you know what I mean. And so I went, oh, okay, this, because you know, also too, have you ever worked in a bakery, Candy? Like, or are you watching like Cupcake Wars on Food Network? Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you're not, but maybe you are, and you're like, that looks so much fun. That'd be mm-hmm. so cute. And then you actually go work in a bakery, and you're like, I smell like butter. Mm-hmm. Like my hands are continually greasy. Like I have flour in my ear. I'm up until 2 a.m. I have to get there at 5 a.m. to bake fucking bread with blueberries in it. I don't even like blueberries. I don't know, Candy. So for me, that's you. I think just get as much information as you get, you know, because this isn't like trying a new dress. This is starting a business. And mm-hmm. so I don't want you to go get a loan. Right. You know, there's a really great book by Timothy Ferris that I've talked about on the show a lot called The 4-Hour Work Week. Go on, Selfie, go loving. But the 4-Hour Work Week, what he talks about testing, mm-hmm. testing your market, mm-hmm. and seeing that, is there a bakery really needed in this town? Not just because a lot of people say, oh, this is going to be a great idea. But then you think about it, they never ask other people if it's a great idea. They never test it out. They never see if it's needed. And then it's mm-hmm. not, you know, it just falls flat. So I wouldn't want that to happen.
And at first, a good strategy is giving stuff away for free.
Yes.
You have a product.
Are you going to give free therapy?
Well, I did.
That's interning.
That's
yeah.
our internships. And building the practice, you know,
and pro you probably bono. Have clients that were you were interning with probably mm-hmm. that stayed with you some.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think you have to, for people to get to know who you are and what you do, mm-hmm. you have to make it very easy for them to find that out. So
yeah,
it might
sure.
be showing up at events and giving away cookies and with your card in it so that people just get to know who you are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There you go. Okay. We have time. One more question. All right. This is from Kimberly, age 35. Dear Maddie, I need to end a friendship, but I don't know how. Mm. I could go into the story about why she's a selfish bitch, but I already know that. All right, Kimberly. That's followed up with, still, I care about her, but I'm just done. Maddie, you're from the South. How do I do it nicely?
Oh, God. This is a tough one.
Oh, you know, there comes a day when you just stop being nice. Mm. I know that you love Oprah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you and I are big. I still have the 20th anniversary that you had because I got it after I saw yours. I still haven't watched it, but I fucking love Oprah. Although I don't have cable. I had so much problems with the Oprah Winfrey Network and Time Warner Cable. That was the only reason I got cable. And for like 8 months, I didn't have the Oprah Winfrey Network. Mm. And now she has this new series on Belief.
Uh-huh.
And I want to watch it so bad. Do you still have cable?
No, actually, we got rid of our cable because we got Apple TV. And
yeah, that's what I have.
Yeah, that's all we have.
That's all I miss is I miss mm-hmm. talk shows and Oprah Winfrey.
Right.
And Food Network.
Yep.
I miss Food Network. I miss Ina Garten. But anyway, Kimberly, So my friend Don I keep doing this, but Dear Maddie episode 5, I think. I didn't plan this. Don McCoy has been on the show a couple of times. She once told us she went to like that Oprah weekend thing that, you know, that's like $1 million. She got to go, I think, for free. Like, but where you and I like would have like blown a busboy to go to that because we would have loved it. Let's be honest, we would have blown them anyway. And so in our 20s. Anyway, so you're like, my husband's listening to this. No, I'm kidding. But anyway, so, but Oprah told this story about some, I don't remember what, Don told it better, but something happened and someone was upset at Oprah and she was talking to Stedman, her boyfriend, partner, and she said, and I'm sure it's Oprah telling the story, so it was, you know, a good way of telling it, but she said basically that I told him I was really upset. And I was like, how dare she not think that I'm not a nice person? And I really try and da da da. And she was actually trying to please this person. And Stedman, he said that he put his hand on his shoulder and he said, Oprah, you're not nice. And she said, what? She's like, I'm nice. And she's like, it like cut me to the core. And he's like, no, you're not. He said, you're kind, but you're not nice. Gail is nice. Which made me laugh, but that's good. But Gail is nice. Like, if you think about it, I love Oprah and like what she's done, but she's not always the nicest. She's very kind. And so the reason I tell that story, Kimberly, is that maybe the kindest thing you can do to this person is to let them go with love. And to do it probably, I think if you really are, want to end the friendship, it's very important for you to be clear with your boundaries. And if that's what you want, and because you don't want to send mixed messages. But I think as far as a nice way of doing it, I would want to talk to you a little bit, Kimberly, in that if there are people in my life that I have, I don't know, have you shut the door on friendships or things in your life? Yeah, I've done that.
And not always in the best way.
No, I haven't either. I haven't.
It can be really tough. And it's figuring out to, I love the idea of it's not about being nice, it's about being kind. And being kind can look like a lot of different things. It can look like a conversation, but it just always depends on the history of your relationship. Do you owe this person a conversation about the relationship? Does it even warrant that? Or is it something that if you just walked away from, then it would be over? Or is it someone that you've had a significant enough relationship with that there is a conversation that would be appropriate and kind to have with that person, that you communicate what you're feeling. And, you know, maybe you know that the relationship's over and that's your boundary, or maybe you just need to have a conversation about what you're dissatisfied with and see what happens. Maybe the relationship will evolve and become something even better because you've had a conversation about it before you ended the
You
ended the relationship.
Yeah, I mean, possibly. I mean, in the relationship, if you want to end it, Kimberly, but has there been a history of honesty in this friendship? And maybe there hasn't. If you said that she's a selfish bitch, is there just not a lot of focusing on what you need? Yeah, I think definitely. I think that I've done it well and I've done it bad before too, as far as ending friendships. You know, I've had a couple of friendships that I thought were going to end totally, and they did. And then I had one friendship that we had like our first fight, it never happened before, and I thought it was done and it was going to end. And then the next thing I know, we had this really great conversation, and now we're even stronger friends because of that conversation, and such a better and understanding of one another. And so I'm glad you brought that up because you made me think about that. And Kimberly, this might be an opportunity for that. That said, if you feel like this person is a very selfish of all person, you know, it's okay to cancel your subscription because you don't need their issues, kind of a deal, and move the fuck on. They said, this is when I wish sometimes people would call in, but I don't have that technology yet. So, or the money to do it, because I think it's expensive. But yeah, I've so many questions, Kimberly. So many questions. It's hard, though. I've done that. Like, not talking about relationships, but like, I almost think a friendship breakup is harder than a relationship to me. I don't know. Do you think that?
That resonates with me. Yeah, I think it.
I can't imagine you doing that. You're so sweet. Who would fuck you over, Rick Coons? Rick Grant Coons?
Not even like from that. Just, you know, where relationships just become unhealthy or a drain.
Yeah,
it's not necessarily that anyone did anything wrong or bad or hurtful. Just that their life circumstances or how they deal with life. One thing that would drive me crazy would be in a relationship where I'm in a relationship with someone and it seems like they never learn from their mistakes or their choices.
Yeah.
And so they continue to have the same conversation over and over
again. It's just boring.
And after a time, it's like I get to a point where I don't feel we're moving on in the relationship because they're staying in the exact same place that they've always been in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for me, it's like, that's not a relationship that I enjoy. And so,
growth at all.
There's no growth. And so I realized at a certain point that we can choose the people that we want around us and who make us feel a certain way by being in their company. And so we can select those people and we don't have to tolerate being in the presence of people that don't add to our life.
Drop the mic, bitches. Drop the mic. All right, everybody. I hope that helped, Kimberly. So best of luck to you. Bless your heart. We have both been there, and I know that is hard. All right, celebrity shit the bed. Dr. Rick Grant Coons. Is there something in the plethora of knowledge in your brain that's just circulating to the front that you want to talk about that you feel like needs to be discussed?
About celebrities?
About celebrities, about, I don't know, something work that's been going on in clinical, in the news, sports. Yeah.
What's so funny, what keeps coming back into my mind, it's the very first thing, because I'm a new fan of The Voice.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. Have you watched this?
I've only seen like clips of it, but no.
Because I'm not in general a big fan of the singing shows, and I think they've become a lot of the talent shows.
Cannot do American Idol. Can't.
Yeah, and I think it's over anyway. But
it is over.
I'm
like,
all right, it's time. But The Voice was, I just started watching it, and it's a whole different idea around singing competitions where the judges, these celebrities, these famous singers, they hear these people and they don't see them. They hear them, and then if they like their voice, they turn around. Then they compete to be each other, the coach. Mm-hmm. Like the coaches compete with each other.
Yeah.
And it's just the whole feel of it is supportive.
It's a smart choice. It's a much more supportive. That's why I don't like American Idol, because you could tell people they push through just so Simon can make fun of them and tell them they're terrible.
Exactly. There's no ugliness like that in the show. And so today I watched a binge of it because I stayed home from work and I binged on three episodes of The Voice. So that's what's wonderful.
I saw a clip of a guy, a white guy, curly hair. He sang something amazing. What did he sing?
Is it the bigger guy that from Kentucky?
Oh, yeah. He's from Kentucky.
He's from Kentucky, and I don't know if he's gay. He could be.
He's gay. Come on.
I'm not.
You're being PC. Gay.
They didn't identify that on the show, but he's got this voice that.
What
is
he sing? There was a first
chandelier.
Yes.
Sia.
He was like,
oh my god!
It was cray cray.
And there are those people that just have this effortless ability to sing those songs and make you feel them. And he's still on the show.
Who did he go with? Adam Lambert. Okay. Yeah. If you were on The Voice, who
Adam
would you
Lambert?
Want?
Not Adam Lambert. His name just.
Is it Blake Shelton?
Adam Levine.
Adam Levine. You said Lambert and I heard Levine.
Right.
You say Levine, I say Lambert.
Although both would be very good coaches.
Both would be very good coaches. Adam Lambert would be great for him.
Uh-huh.
Who would you want to be your coach on The Voice?
Pharrell's on it this year.
Oh my gosh, he's so cute.
And I have probably musically, I probably think he's the most creative and fascinating.
Yeah.
Adam Levine, just because I would hopefully
see him shirtless.
Have an intimate moment, yeah, or see him shirtless.
So Adam Levine does it for you.
Oh God, he's
quite a little skinny pretty. For me. I feel he like is. I'd break him, but he's very cute.
Yeah,
he's very cute,
but he's not like underfed skinny. He's no, just kind of no, like no. Tone skinny.
He's just vegan.
Yeah.
That's what that is.
Yeah. So those would probably be the two that I would choose from.
I part of me would want to pick Blake Shelton because he's in from Oklahoma, but I don't know. I don't know. Probably if I sang anything, if I could be a singer, I would want to be like a country or bluegrass singer more than anything.
Yeah. Right.
I like jazz and musical theaters, but that's the genre. What about you?
I would want to sound like any black female.
Oh,
vocal.
Well, yes, we're gay. We're gay men. We love black females. That's yeah, what
those are the guys that usually like, you know. Well, one of my favorite singers is Shoshana Bean. Who?
Oh, I love Shoshana Bean.
I just wish I could just sit in a chair and wail. Like
she's
her
and ridic.
Just takes you to church.
Yeah, she does take you to church. One of the things that I was probably most proud of in my life, in my singing career, was after Whitney Houston died, I was just kind of like cleaning and singing in my apartment, and like Whitney Houston was on, and my neighbor who lives across the way is a photographer, film person, and she's like, can I film you singing Whitney Houston? I was like, sure, I don't care. I'd like been day drinking.
Right.
So I was like, sure. So she put it on YouTube or whatever. I think like 12 people have watched it. But I was singing, you know, Saving All My Love for You, and mm-hmm. I sing it, I have a pretty strong falsetto, so when I sing like Whitney, I sing up high. Uh-huh. And I don't sound like Whitney, but I just do it for the fun of it. And it's just, honestly too, and I mean this in a good way, it's just so amazingly gay, mm-hmm. like affirming for me to do it. It's like mm-hmm. this dude, like with the beer gut, to be like, but anyway, so, but one of the most proud moments is that somebody tagged on Facebook, they're like, Matt Maher, look at you. And somebody made a list of like top 10 tributes to Whitney Houston after her death. And I was like number 5.
Wow.
And I was like, I made it. That was my voice moment.
Yes.
I don't know why I told that story, but I did. All right. Well, that's a good Michael Bellavia loves Dear Maddie episode something. I really need to get friends that aren't on my show. All right. So this we're at the last part of the show. This is Chatty Maddie questions. Okay. Same 5 questions every week. Mm-hmm. I ask people. So now I'm asking you.
Great.
All right. Number 1, what is your most memorable or favorite childhood smell?
Ooh. Childhood smell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the smells that like bring me right back to childhood, mm-hmm. and they're not like, ooh, this smells great, but I go back to childhood.
Yeah. I love the smell of diesel.
Yeah. That's
what you're going to say?
Just going to say diesel gas because I'm waiting for the bus. There's also like a milk smell that reminds me of a cafeteria. Like I'm back in elementary school cafeteria, like a milky something, not like bad milk.
It's like milk and bleach.
No, I think so.
That's a cafeteria.
Yeah, bleach and milk.
So you think of diesel because you were waiting for
the bus. Yeah, waiting for the school bus
in front of your house. Or
I went to a few different schools that had bus stops, but they usually were either down the street or one was half a mile away.
I'm imagining you, little Rick, walking down a country road, the trees blowing, mm-hmm. carrying your lunch pail, your mm-hmm. What did you have a lunch? Who was on your lunch pail?
What was on my lunch pail? I had a few of them.
That's a good Chatty Maddie question. I should say that for every week.
You know, I can't remember. I can't remember.
I always wanted a Wonder Woman. Never got it.
They were so important. Yeah.
They were so important. I think I had like Superman, Batman.
Yeah.
I
remember my biggest thing was the Trapper Keepers. That was the thing I looked forward to the most.
That was my favorite thing about school. It was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
We like organizing things, I think.
Yeah.
I feel like your home is very organized. Are you like the more clean organized or Stu?
No, Stu is way more because he even his job and all that, it's so detail oriented.
Oh yeah, he's a surgeon.
Well, he's a perfusionist, so he works with surgeons and heart and lung operations, and working to perfuse the blood. And it's all about knobs and buttons and things. And he's way more organized. I'm more like big picture kind of thinker. I don't do as well with the nitty gritty all the time. Yeah. I partner. If I have a good partner, that's that kind of role, mm-hmm. rigid organization mm-hmm. can partner up with me, then we usually make a great team.
Well, it sounds like you have, okay. decent. All right. What would be the name of your memoir? It's okay to have silence. It's a podcast. People always wanted, I feel like they to fill it. I'm like, it's not live radio.
Life at its fullest.
Oh, see, everybody always says something like funny or kind of self-deprecating, like one of, but I love that, life at its fullest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, my whole motto with life, there was some quote that I really loved was like, we only have a certain amount of heartbeats and I don't want to waste a single one of them.
Oh, I love that.
And just the concept of time's ticking. So
yeah.
Make everything that you want to do count.
Yeah, make it count.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. All right.
Oh, maybe make it count. Maybe that would be the name. Oh,
make it count. All right. Okay, I like that. So what day that you've had in your life would be your Groundhog Day that you'd want to just live again and again?
What would be my Groundhog Day? Probably my wedding.
That get a lot of
that. Oh, yeah.
But it's true, though.
Oh, it was such a great day.
Normally, this is when I ask people about that, but I talked to you. I mean, that just sounds beautiful.
Yeah.
And also, too, it's... I don't think that we thought as men, gay men in our, mm-hmm. I want to still say mid, but let's be honest, I'm getting to late 30s. I thought that this would happen maybe when I was 50 or mm-hmm. 60.
Mm-hmm.
Like I kind of thought, oh, hopefully I'll find somebody. And maybe when we're retired, we'll finally be able to get married.
Mm-hmm.
So I just...
Yeah, it was always a dream. It was quite a day when it became a reality.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you know, I'd always thought that, oh, I'll have a ceremony. Like, I'll mm-hmm. have a ceremony with family and friends. I was going to do that regardless.
Yeah.
I was going to make that happen.
But it's different.
When it was the real deal.
The real deal.
And there we were with my parents and brothers and his parents and siblings. And it was like, wow, I can't believe this actually became real.
I'm going to have to go back on your Facebook and look at pictures. All right. What is the best piece of advice? Let me say that again. Chatty Manny number 4. What's the best piece of advice you wish you had taken earlier?
Best piece of advice that I wish I'd taken earlier. just not to give a fuck.
No, that's so you good. Know,
just it made I learned that slowly, that when I really placed more value on what I thought than and it may be cliche to say, oh, I don't care what people think of me, and I don't find that to be completely true.
Mm-hmm.
I think we do care, and I think we care more about certain people's opinions than others. Mm-hmm. But regardless, what I realized was valuing my own opinion.
Mm-hmm. Just as much as theirs.
Just as much as theirs, but probably more.
More. Yeah, because you go to bed with you.
Yeah.
I love that. Maybe I mentioned it before. There was like an article on Yahoo News or whatever. Somebody's probably making all this up. But still, they did a survey it was like octogenarians, whatever, people in their 80s
right.
and things like that, and ask them, you know, what was the one thing? And like overwhelming, this group of like several hundred seniors in the study said they just wish they would not have worried.
Mm-hmm.
They wish they wouldn't have worried about the bills, the houses, and that. That was all kind of fruitless.
Right.
So don't give a fuck. Give less fucks, everyone. all right, Chatty Matty number 5. When are you most inspired?
In the morning. Really, I've always been a early morning person, and I'm ready to go, and my brain's working the best early in the morning. So that's when I will sit down and.
Do you have a ritual that you do, or
no? I mean, I'm usually getting ready for the day, and which usually involves work. So if I usually get my workout done in the morning, mm-hmm. it's the first thing I do. Or just time to putz around and just not have to get up and just go, but mm-hmm. just can drink coffee and surf the web and just have some time to myself to start mm-hmm. the day. But that was also the time where if I had to write papers, or just really get anything significant done. Those mm-hmm. are the best hours to really be productive.
I bet you just felt after you finished your degree and were done with all that, it was kind of like, wow, I have a whole life again now.
It was pre-license and post-license was a huge, whole different world.
Whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
And then you have to take an exam as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You have to take two, the national and the state.
It's not the same exams that MFTs take, is it?
No. Similar material, but very different tests.
Very different tests.
Yeah. Because it also includes some things that you don't cover in the master's level. You don't cover statistics and things like that, which was not my cup of tea. Ooh. So I had to study hard, and I don't remember any of it.
You just put it in there to get it out.
Put it in there. You know, I know what people are talking about, but I couldn't tell you how to do any of it.
And you probably won't ever need to.
No. Nope.
That's the beauty of that. Tell people where they can find you, of all things Dr. Rick Gregson.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm moving, so there's a lot of
But I'm transition. Sure you're on the World Wide Web.
I am. I mean, right now I have, and I'm working on a new website. I'm rebranding myself.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm moving to a new city. But right now it's drrickcoons.com. You can find me, but eventually it will be empoweredlivingtherapy.com.
Oh, love it.
Mm-hmm. That's my new one.
You bought that one, did you?
I did.
Good. I like it.
Looking at several others, but I was so grateful that was available. And the website's almost done, and I'll launch that. And both links will still get you there. So either drrickcoons.com or empoweredlivingtherapy.com.
That's wonderful. Well, great, 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 great. Well, thank you.
Thank you for having me here.
Yeah. And for doing this. I always appreciate it. I hope you all enjoyed it at home. You know the drill. Go to DearMattyShow.com. You can find out all information about the classes I talked about today, but also too, you can just listen to shows. Submit your questions. There's a little Ask Maddie, because it's what your desires and thoughts are what drives this show more than anything. You can find me on social media at TheMattMar. And last but not least, do something for someone this week. Get out there and do something nice. All right. Thank you again to Dr. I can't stop saying it, Dr. Rick Van Coons. I appreciate you. I love you. You're wonderful. And we'll see you. And I love all you listeners too. We'll see you next week. Bye.